British Columbia. I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies. Watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger. You'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is March 14th, 2019, and this is episode 129. Happy Pi Day. Do people celebrate that?
I think so.
I sometimes use the calendar on like a 2-pi counting system, and so Pi Day would be like July 1st because it's halfway through the year. That's the kind of engineering nerd I am.
That is too nerdy for Pi Day.
It's also the eve of the Ides of March, which is fitting given the ongoing state of Trudeau's leadership. Politicos is the BC Politics Podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple dollars a month at patreon.com/politicos.
Start the limb boom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, should the police be able to take your stuff? And more ongoing SNC-Lavalin drama. Politicos is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicos enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free 2-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. First up, should the police be able to take your stuff? Earlier today, I had the pleasure to speak with Megan McDermott from the BC Civil Liberties Association about the new changes to the province's civil asset forfeiture regime and what that will mean for your rights. Spoiler alert, bad. Let's throw it over to that interview. I also talk a little bit with her about the new anti-slap legislation that the civil libertarians are quite pleased with. Let's listen to that conversation now. Welcome to Politicos, Megan McDermott. We're bringing you on from the BC Civil Liberties Association to talk about this new bill the BC NDP have brought forward to revise the rules around civil asset forfeiture in the province. Now, the BCCLA is speaking out against this, and I think the first question most people will have is, what is civil asset forfeiture?
Okay, civil asset forfeiture is when the Office of Civil Forfeiture, they can commence proceedings to have assets forfeited to them if they believe that they are either an instrument of or the proceeds of an unlawful activity. So that's a very broad scope of activities. Originally, this type of legislation was sold to the public as targeting crime and organized crime specifically. However, it's been used more broadly. So if the director of civil forfeiture has reason to believe, and in practicality what happens is it's based on reports that are submitted from police forces across the province, there can be proceedings begun in court, or if the assets are worth less than $75,000, they can just do it more administratively, like without even having to go into court to get those assets forfeited. But the key concern here that we have with it, and that we think a lot of people share with us, is that there need not be any type of criminal charges having been laid. There need not be a conviction. Or if there is a conviction, the conviction can be suspended. All of that is irrelevant to whether or not the assets can be seized. As long as the director can convince a court, if it does end up in court, because like I said, if it's under $75,000, the defendant has to push to get it into court and then have to, you know, pay for the defense. And then anything above $75,000, the court just has to decide on a balance of probabilities that that asset was linked to unlawful activity and not necessarily a crime. So that is civil forfeiture in a nutshell.
So basically people can have their stuff taken by the cops if it's been decided that, you know, that stuff has been involved in a crime.
Yeah.
The thing you highlight there is though that balance of probabilities, that's a different standard than, you know, the beyond a reasonable doubt that people think of when they talk about someone's convicted of a crime, correct?
Right. And that's a very fundamental difference. So with a criminal conviction, the burden is on the Crown to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt that the person committed the crime. And usually with crimes, for a lot, most criminal offenses, they have to prove that there was an intent to commit the crime. That necessity for the mental intention of the criminal isn't required in regulatory offenses that can also be used as the basis for forfeiture here. So there is a criminal forfeiture process, and that's federal law, and it can be done pursuant to conviction. So once the Crown has discharged its very high burden of convincing a court beyond a reasonable doubt that a criminal offense has occurred, at that point, they're able to get at the assets that are related to that crime. At that point, the evidence test is one of balance of probabilities, but it is after a conviction has already occurred. In the case of the Civil Forfeiture Act and all the other ones that exist in provinces across Canada, there's only that lower threshold of the balance of probabilities. There's no need for any trier of fact to determine that somebody has actually broken the law.
So if someone's stuff is taken, what recourse do they have? Like you said, people's assets can be seized if they haven't even been tried or convicted. Say the police
right.
think my podcast equipment has been used in all kinds of crimes, and then they seize it, and it's worth less than $75,000, so we don't even have a trial or a court hearing over it. How do I get my stuff back?
If it was under $75,000, the asset would end up in the government's hand if you don't decide to dispute it within a certain amount of time. I think it might be 2 months or something. I might have that wrong. But basically, you'd just be served with notice of the intention to do this. And then if you don't reply, then by default, under operation of the law, it would end up in the government's hands. Now, how they would actually seize it, I don't know the practicalities of that, but it would be legally theirs. But if you were like, no, my podcast equipment, this is mine, I worked hard for this, and I don't believe with your determination, Mr. Director, over there in Victoria in your office, then it would go into the court. So you'd end up in court, and you'd have to, depending on what the government is arguing about, so they've put a number of presumptions in the amendments that were introduced last week. And offhand, I don't think any of them would really affect you with your podcast equipment. It has to do specifically with vehicles, cash, and unless they thought that you were doing a part of a criminal organization. But basically, the burden has shifted even higher for a defendant in certain cases, but I don't think that these amendments would apply to your podcast equipment. So what you'd have to do is go to court and convince them on a balance of probabilities that it has not been either purchased with the proceeds of an unlawful activity, or that you're not using it to do something that's unlawful. And that might actually be very difficult for you to do and very expensive. A really kind of sad symptom of the state of affairs in this realm is that there's not many experts in this area of law, because it's kind of a mixture of, well, it is. It's an overlap of civil litigation and then criminal law. So the criminal bar isn't really as seized of the issue as they could be, because they're always in court defending, you know, people charged with crimes and dealing with the purely criminal forfeitures. So they might not feel as comfortable going in to try to, you know, stop the forfeiture of assets for that same client. So we think that really a lot of the expertise is being held and developed by just government lawyers themselves, because it's such a unique little niche area of law. So as I've been doing some media interviews, I've been asked a few times, like, well, you know, how would you rebut this presumption? And I said, well, that's a great question. And, you know, on its face to me, it seems a bit absurd, and it seems like a very high threshold that a defendant's going to have to overcome. Like, if we move a bit from your radio equipment example, mm-hmm. there's a new presumption in here about cash. So if cash is found stored in a way, to be fair, it is cash in the amount of $10,000 or more. But if it's bundled or packaged in a manner that isn't consistent with standard banking practices, like, that's it. The presumption is now in the law that is proof that the cash is the proceed of unlawful activity.
Right. So if I, for whatever reason, take a giant withdrawal from the bank, go home, and rewrap my money because I like it stacked in a different way, I'm essentially guilty.
Yeah, exactly. That's going to be the effect of one of these new amendments.
Right.
Is just baked into the statute itself now is that presumption. And so you're going to have to hire a pretty good lawyer. You're going to have to represent yourself very well in a very niche, cutting-edge area of law that many say are unconstitutional. And, you know, it's going to be quite an uphill battle for you.
So to sort of tie together the whole issue, even before we get into some of the more other specifics about the new law, is basically the government has lowered the bar for evidence just in general with the civil asset forfeiture from the high standard to reasonable probabilities. They flipped the burden of proof so that it's actually on the person to prove they're innocent. And then there's not even lawyers who really know what they're doing on this. I mean, there are some, but not many.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've mentioned a few of the changes that are being brought about. Is there anything good in this new bill, or is it all just kind of clarifying the regime and adding what you consider to be some worrying presumptions?
Our fundamental position of the Civil Liberties Association is that the entire regime is just wrong. So it's difficult for me to say that some of them are less controversial than others, but I'll give you exactly what it's doing. So the two other things that the amendments are doing, one of them is just allowing the director of this office to seek the assets to be frozen before starting any other proceedings under the Act. So that presumably is to stop somebody who's going to be the target of this unfair regime, stop them from transferring their assets or otherwise liquidating it in some way, and then, you know, hiding it from the reach of government. The other thing that it's doing is allowing the director to get information from financial institutions and also requiring the financial institution not to let the account holder know that they're sharing information about their accounts with this office. So those are the ones that I'd say are less controversial and that could be sold as just streamlining the regime. But as we see with all of them, it's really just helping us stack the deck more in favor of the province and making this fundamentally unfair system work more efficiently, more quickly, and to cut more corners.
Well, even that latter amendment you talk about with the working with financial institutions would seem to be a worrying invasion into privacy of someone who is innocent in the eyes of the law.
Right.
And it's not even going to the RCMP, right? It's going to this additional body.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just, a civil servant in an office, so not police. They don't need to get a warrant or anything. And they can ask for this information under the law. A financial institution's going to have to provide it. And I'm looking at it really quickly. Requirement not to disclose the existence of the notice. It's all in legal speak, but but really what it's doing is allowing information about your financial interest to be shared without you knowing about it. And short of having a court warrant, which would be required in the criminal investigation realm. But because, again, this is the key word here, civil, it's a civil proceeding, not criminal. And yeah, it's very worrying because they could be snooping around about your financial information and never end up following up with it at all. So you might never have known that was ever even looked into.
Mm-hmm.
And privacy law, like what this does is creates an exception to privacy law, which is essentially that all your personal information is only between you and whoever you expressly consent to share it with. So this is overriding that consent provision that exists as a default in privacy law.
Well, in terms of the more worrying provisions, then you've mentioned a couple of the presumptions. Are there other changes in there that we should be, you know, protesting in the streets about?
I think we should be protesting in the streets that, you know, we've had this act now since 2006. And, you know, the longer that goes on and as it gets further expanded, it's being more and more normalized. Aside from the ones that I've already pointed out, I mean, if you just want additional examples, here's another one. If a motor vehicle doesn't stop within a reasonable period of time after being signaled or requested to stop by a peace officer, that's another new presumption in the law that by virtue of this law now, the law will treat that as proof that the motor vehicle is an instrument of unlawful activity. So the government keeps wanting to point this as something that only affects criminals and that if you're not a criminal, then you have nothing to worry about. And they've also engaged in what some people would call charity washing, where you make some of the revenue that you've gotten through these forfeiture, you make them available through grants to charities, and they love to promote that. So so that they try to insulate themselves from the critiques about what they're doing, because then, you know, people who are dissenting can be seen as not supporting these. Because there are a bunch of great community groups who've gotten wonderful grants. But again, that's just obfuscating the really unfair presence of this law even to begin with.
Mm-hmm. At a higher level, is there
yes.
an oversight mechanism for this office? Anything envisioned? Do they have to justify on an annual basis all of the assets they've collected to, say, the legislature?
I was looking before I talked to you, I was looking to see if the Auditor General has looked into this office, and they haven't. But I think in theory, the Auditor General could. I don't know of anything that would bar them from doing an audit of the office, and I think that that would be very welcome. However, I don't see a need for them to make an annual report. That's something that we like to see for a whole bunch of different bureaucratic institutions to hold them accountable, is to at least see what they're doing with their money every year. And if they have any particular targets or objectives of policy or law, they could even evaluate that and measure that. So, I mean, we don't even know whether or not the objective of this office, which it, we are told is to create a disincentive to crime and to provide compensation to victims. We don't have any evidence yet. There's been no oversight body that's been able to show us one way or the other whether or not it is fulfilling that objective. I do know that for the first number of years of the office, I think from 2006 to 2012, the first 6 years, there wasn't any money from the office dispersed back to victims whatsoever. I think after that they started to disperse them, but it would be excellent to have some kind of oversight body look into the Civil Forfeiture Office to audit them to see if what they're doing is having any effect, and also that recurring accountability mechanism, like requiring them to place a report before the legislature every year. That would be welcome as well.
Yeah, I did see some numbers in a National Observer piece, or I think it might have been Canadian Press, that your colleague Michael Vaughan was quoted in, where the director of the office says they've brought in $87 million since 2006, and only $1.6 million has gone to victims, while another $37.5 million has been spent on crime prevention, and the rest just on lawyers and the office supplies. $87 million over 13 years. Some people might argue that's not a lot, but do you know, is there any, I guess we don't have any information on the kinds of people who are being impacted by this law, do we?
No, aside from the ones that are willing to challenge any kind of proceedings and that go public with it. Those are the only ones that we can really see. But one of our suspicions, and many people share this with us, is that not random who they go after. Because the office itself is funded through forfeitures, that creates an incentive for the office to go after more expensive luxury items. So what you see over and over again is that, you know, vehicles like Ferraris are being seized and not Honda Civics. Now, we don't want to see either of those being seized, short of being pursuant to a criminal conviction. But from looking in the news, it seems that a lot of the assets that are seized are really big ticket items, like rooming house buildings, expensive houses worth multiple millions of dollars, Ducati motorcycles. They tried to seize one of those after its driver was just broke the speed limit, but that was enough to trigger unlawful activity. So they go after more big ticket items. And I think, you know, over time, it's just going to be a function of when you set up the machinery that it has to fund itself. And then also it's trying to sell itself as giving grants to community groups that are going to do crime prevention and also to police services. Police can also apply for more equipment from these funds. But also some of the funds are being transferred just into general revenue, and it's being normalized as a stream of revenue for the government to use for whatever purpose. So it's not all being put back into the community or into crime prevention, as they like to say.
Right. Well, before I switch gears and just finish quickly on anti-SLAPP, what is the BC Civil Liberties Association doing, or what can listeners do to help challenge this regime?
Well, unfortunately, at the provincial level, there's not a committee system in our legislature the way there is in Ottawa. What we would be trying to do if this was playing out federally, we'd be trying to get ourselves before committee. We'd be making a policy submission and going and speaking, providing evidence to the committee. But there's no procedure like that built into the provincial legislative process. We can hope that, you know, in talking to your listeners and other people in the public, other media, that we can get concerned citizens to reach out to their politicians or to the government generally. The most we can really do is just talk to government. We can send a letter, ask them to stop this. We were caught off guard by this. We were not consulted with. So there may not be room, because we figure, you know, if they were going to be sympathetic to our concerns, they probably would have asked us already, or they probably know what our position is, so it wouldn't come as a surprise to them if we were to send them a letter. So we'll try to just slow down the process or stop it. I mean, what we'd like to see is really just repeal the law that came into effect in 2006. And every time that we see it expand, we fight back against it just by educating our fellow citizens. But like I say, the politics of right now, it doesn't seem like there will be a real opportunity for us to have any influence to slow this one down. I was wanting to look at a cancer, but I haven't had the time. I know that the current government, when they are in opposition, they supported a review of the act. So I had wanted to look at what their criticisms were when they were in opposition, because now they seem to be very supportive and saying they're now quite assured that the office is functioning very well and doing what it set out to do. But the rest of us, I don't think, can be as convinced. We don't have access to the same information they do and the same reports. We can't call in the bureaucrats to be accountable to us each and every day. So just seeing the kind of 180 that the government has done with respect to this also leads me to believe that there's not much room to maneuver in terms of getting an amendment to these amendments, or maybe they just won't see the light of day. If there's enough public outrage against it, and I guess with the precarious nature of the BC government right now, that was something we were worried about with the Protection of Public Participation Act. Last year it was tabled, and then it actually didn't make it to third reading. And then there was that issue with the Nanaimo seat and the by-election, and potentially having another provincial election. We were worried that, oh no, maybe that will never see the light of day. So that can happen with the Civil Forfeiture Act. But I mean, it's great that you're interviewing and talking about it, because I just get the feeling that it's not something that's high on everybody's radar. People have tended to be placated by the idea that, you know, it's just criminals and those fentanyl dealers and those Hells Angels that got caught up in this scheme.
Yeah, and the government's keen to be looking to appear to be doing something about organized crime and money laundering and all of this, even if that's maybe not the most constitutionally just way to do it, or even effective. I guess if there's no room to move forward on the political side, or only so much room, the BCCLA will undoubtedly probably be there should this end up in court again. I mean, in the past, it has been. It's not a secret, and has been a good intervener on those cases. So I'm sure listeners can always donate to support the general work. And I can say that as a board member, right? People should be donating to support those legal challenges when they come up.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation Act, or the acronym that you actually got right. I just call it the anti-slap law.
Yeah.
Where we were just harshly critical of the government, here's something that I think the BCCLA has been celebrating. So just for people who aren't aware, what is the point of an anti-slap law, and how does it fix that problem?
All right. So anti-slap laws are trying to get at the problem of, it's typically kind of painted as a David and Goliath issue. So there's a citizen speaking out about something that is a public concern. It's, you know, something that has a public interest dimension to it. So it could be about how the government's doing things, about, you know, potentially rezoning a neighborhood, or it could be about, you know, a new, or a company wants to start a new gravel pit near my child's school. So I'm going to speak out about it. And then the giant comes along, the Goliath, and serves me with papers saying, see you in court. And so the giant, in most cases, tend to be corporations with deep pockets, but they can also be the government, which kind of has infinite assets, very deep pockets. And if they don't like what they're hearing, what they've tended to do in a way that works to silence these citizen critics is just to serve them with papers saying, see you in court. And usually that just intimidates the person so much, even just the prospect of having to hire a lawyer, figure out what they're being sued for. It can take such an emotional toll on people that oftentimes it just has the effect right away of silencing the critics. And the court process itself is used as the punishment and the disincentive to speak. There's no idea really that it's ever going to get resolved in court. It's the punishment is just the infliction of court on that person who's speaking out. And knowing that in many, many, many cases, because of the emotional toll and the financial toll, that person is going to either stop speaking out or they're going to settle out of court in a way that's never been made public. So an example of this is protests on Burnaby Mountain a few years ago. There were six protesters that were actually sued for intimidating Kinder Morgan workers. And whether or not they actually intimidated the workers, the idea wasn't really to get that in court because five out of six of the people just settled out of court immediately because they were so intimidated. The prospect of being sued, I think they were sued for $6 million. So there you are, you're just protesting at Burnaby Mountain, which is something that a lot of Vancouverites have been doing in recent years and just expressing themselves. And then you get a lawsuit from a massive multinational oil and gas company saying, hey, we're suing you for $6 million because you intimidated our workers. So that worked for five out of six of them. One guy would not back down. He's gone very public. His name's Alan Dutton. If you look him up, he and his lawyer have spoken out a lot about the need for this kind of legislation. So that's what a slap suit is, strategic lawsuit against public participation, often wielded by big corporations and also governments. I think in Ontario a few years ago, there was a fellow, I don't know what municipality, but he filed a complaint about his local fire services. And he just filed the complaint with the oversight committee, kind of like the chief fire person of all of Ontario. And then his local municipality sued him for defamation, saying that, you know, because he was critiquing his own local government firefighting services, that he had ruined their reputation. And in that case, that might have been, I can't remember what happened in that case, but we had been pointing to Ontario for a long time because they were the ones who kind of led the pack of Canadian jurisdictions in bringing about this law to protect people. So they've had one there, I think, I might get the year wrong, but I think 2014, 2015. So we've started to see how this law can work in Canada because previously we had to point to the United States and it's not always as transferable to talk about the legal systems here and there. So it's been very illuminating to see what's happened in Ontario. It actually has worked out pretty well. It's protected a lot of people. There have been appeals made to the Ontario Court of Appeal and on a constitutional basis. And the Ontario Court of Appeal has upheld the regime. And the BC's Protection of Public Participation Act is modeled largely on Ontario's scheme. There are some subtle differences, but we were hoping to see that. So it was good to see that it didn't depart too much. There had been a Protection of Public Participation Act here in BC in the late 90s, which would have been a big departure. We did not want to see that one brought back into force. I think it was only in force for about 3 months and the government changed and then repealed it right away. So we're happy with the model that's been put forward, and we're excited to see how it changes the public debate in BC. Because underlying our push for this is the idea that a robust democracy really requires all different opinions and voices, and even having some of the weaker individuals in the society speaking out in dissent against the larger and more resourceful individuals in society. And so we expect to see, you know, a richer, better dialogue happening in the public sphere about what's happening in our province.
That's an optimistic note to end on, I think. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Megan, before I let you go?
No, no, it's great. I'm so glad that you're interested in this, and I hope that your listeners have found it interesting.
All right. Thank you once again for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Take care, Ian.
All right.
Moving on to segment two, cover up at the Justin Committee. Get it? Because Justin Trudeau's running the Justice Committee. It's what the opposition's trying to make stick. It's not quite Fetch level of not sticking, but it's close.
The Conservatives try. And I appreciate its attempt. This whole scandal is meat for the Conservatives and the NDP. And I think it's actually really bad for any other party like Elizabeth May or Maxime Bernier, who we haven't heard from in a while. I guess May did get to ask one question, but no one's paid any attention to Maxime in a while. And that's maybe the best thing to come out of this affair. But let's touch in on what the latest potpourri of news on SNC is.
Yes, where we last left off, I think the Prime Minister had just given his not apology concession.
Press conference.
Yeah.
It was
bizarre. That was like leaked for a week that this was going to be a big conciliatory press conference. It wasn't.
What was the phrase he used? There's been an erosion of trust.
Yes.
It's the most passive voice he could say. Things just went awry. You know, it's really unfortunate that she felt pressured by all of us continually asking her to change her mind on what was clearly a firm decision. Too bad. So that was Trudeau's poor press conference, and it was poorly received. You did cover that for a quick emergency podcast. That was something you had meant for me to actually include in the last episode, and I just did not check my email before editing and publishing. The other thing that sort of follows up from the testimonies last week is we got to see some of the tweets that Michael Wernick considers to be...
Witness intimidation was the word he used. I think cyberbullying got thrown around a bit too.
So he's been called a traitor and a liar.
It's not nice things to say, and like, we obviously don't support cyberbullying of public officials, but...
Or anyone.
That generally. Too, yes.
But, yeah.
It's, at the same time, like, it is Twitter. It's a cesspool. It's pretty much what's par for the course. And, well, there's a reason none of the MPs who get this stuff on a daily basis seem that impressed by it.
It was clearly a distraction attempt from the ongoing scandals. And it just really further undermines his entire credibility, which is also worrying given he's the guy in charge of the committee overlooking foreign influence in the upcoming election.
Yeah, if you're a liar becomes witness intimidation, what's the cutoff now for foreign interference? Because that is the thing he's supposed to tell all the parties about if it happens in the election, and he needs to have the credibility to do that, and it seems to me he pretty much just shot any credibility he had on this.
He's going to be the Wernick who cried wolf. Yeah, that's Michael Wernick. Next up in the long list we have here is SNC suffered a little bit of a loss at the federal court.
Yeah, so once the prosecution had told SNC they weren't going to grant them a DPA, SNC filed with the court to try and force the prosecution to reconsider. And the court was like, nope, we're not going to tell the prosecution how to do their job in absent an abusive process, which this obviously isn't, because it is entirely reasonable for a prosecutor to decide not to take this easy way out for the company. And like overall, this was pretty much expected, but I think it does kind of reinforce, this time from the court, the fact that the prosecution does get to be fairly independent.
Yeah, the judge, this is Justice Kane, quotes from a previous Supreme Court ruling saying the quasi-judicial function of the Attorney General cannot be subjected to interference from parties who are not as competent to consider the various factors involved in making a decision to prosecute. To subject such decisions to political interference or to judicial supervision, which is now both of the things that SNC has asked for, could erode the integrity of our system of prosecution. Based on that, she concludes they had no reasonable prospect of success in the context of the law and the governing jurisprudence. So sad, SNC. You actually have to fight this out in court. So where that was bad news for SNC, more bad news came out for Prime Minister Trudeau and his leadership, as MP Selena Caesar Chavanez came forward to the Globe and Mail to explain the cryptic tweet she'd left.
Yeah, so shortly after Trudeau's press conference, where Trudeau had, I think, a couple times said something along the lines of, well, if Jody Wilson-Raybould felt pressured, she should have come to me. She should have talked to me about it. You know, I'm there. I would have listened. I don't know why she didn't do it. To which Liberal MP Selena Caesar Chavanez says, she tweeted at him, I did come to you recently twice. Remember your reaction? And the Globe obviously saw that. I was like, well, that's interesting. Followed up with it. And Friday afternoon dropped a story where Caesar Chavez talks about how she went to the prime minister to say, hey, I'm not running again. And he kind of blew up at her.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
But I guess the first time was on the day Jody Wilson-Raybould resigned.
It's like, admittedly, that's not a great time to tell your boss you're leaving.
I think the timing was Caesar Chavanez had come forward not knowing the other bit was about to drop. And so that was an accident. So Trudeau, his argument is, oh, could you hold off? The less good part is where he says it would look really bad for us if we had two women of color resign on the same day. Which is true, which is a true statement. But you kind of don't want to use that as the white man in charge to one of your women of color.
Oh, so like two MPs quitting in the same, like that would have been bad regardless.
Yeah. So she characterizes the meeting as hostile and aggressive. And supposedly there are other accounts of this that the Globe did manage to verify.
Because there was another confrontation, this time I think in a more public hallway, I believe.
Yeah, where they came together to try to patch things up and it went as bad, which is not great. So she's interestingly still wearing the Liberal jersey, but going to just not run again in October. And so we now have three women who've taken strong positions opposing Trudeau.
Well, it's also, yeah, it's worth pointing out here that she's not actually deciding not to run because of the SNC scandal. It's just that being a member of parliament is a terrible lifestyle. And like, it has a lot of drain on just, you know, family relation and everything else. So it was, you know, for entirely reasonable personal reasons.
We talked about with Nathan Cullen the previous week, like it can be viewed as him positioning himself for a future premiership run or to come back at a better time for the federal NDP. But it's also
the
draining.
Hours are terrible.
Yes.
There's a lot of downsides to it. Like, I get why politicians decide to leave public life after a while.
But she clearly decided to come to the Globe and Mail and go public about this because of the SNC stuff.
Yes. Yeah, I think if Trudeau hadn't made a point of saying that he would be, you know, open and welcoming to anyone coming to him with issues, this probably would not have surfaced.
So that was the salt in the wound on that file.
And yeah, people were talking, oh, was Trudeau finally going to put this behind him? And no, because this dropped. It also led to a series of op-eds on does Trudeau have a woman problem, where, you know, does what's come out recently kind of go against the public image he's put forward as a very feminist leader?
Yes, it does. It does dig at his whole reputation. His campaign was real change, and now it looks like we have a similar dictatorial style, which was the harshest criticism of Harper, just with better hair. And that's not great. Although, amusingly enough, in a way, I guess, Harper never had this problem with female cabinet members. He didn't have as many, but maybe he just didn't have cabinet members willing to speak their mind by the end because of the control he sought.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. So Chong quit early in the cabinet over Quebec. But yeah, and he had to fire Bernier. But yeah, other than that, though, I don't think there was a huge issues with cabinet with Harper. Definitely not something that blew up like this.
Not for over a month. And not just for so long, but this has gone so international that not only has the foreign press picked up on it, but the OECD has decided to issue a special statement of concern about the bribery allegations tied up in all of this.
Yeah, and this is significant because the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, has a bunch of conventions which its members sign on to, one of them being the anti-bribery one, the one that's language we basically adopted into the deferred prosecution legislation that says you can't use national economic interest as a factor when deciding how to proceed.
And when the whole SNC controversy is over whether to charge them with bribery charges relating to Muammar Gaddafi, it seems to be a relevant thing for the OECD to weigh in on.
Yes, and it explicitly refutes Michael Warnick's interpretation, shall we say, of what economic interest means from his testimony to the Justice Committee, where he basically said that it can only mean relative to other countries, not the fact that it's, you know, would just be not great for, potentially not great for Canada. And that 9,000 job number is highly doubtful, as several good pieces from, I think, The Globe, CBC, there's been quite a few that have dug into at The Star as well. That 9,000 jobs number just is not very credible. Yeah, so they talked about that. And also, the fact that the OECD felt the need to say something is concerning. I believe this is basically the second statement the OECD's ever made about Canada in relation to corruption and bribery.
And I think I did see some liberals trying to tout that as, like, partisans, not MPs, trying to tout that. Well, MPs are partisan. Some hacks on Twitter trying to tout that as a good thing. Like, look, this is only the second time we've gotten in trouble.
This audio medium is not doing a great job of registering the incredulous look I have on my face right now.
It's the sort of whataboutism that you see used so often to, like, distract from the actual issue at hand. It's like, why should we care about women's rights in Canada? Women are being killed in other countries for not covering up in the right ways. Or, you know, gay people have it pretty good in Canada. They're not being thrown off buildings. And it's like...
And I've actually seen that sort of argument be made in relation to SNC is like, well, other countries don't do this well, usually in relation to something like Southern Europe or something.
It's such a race to the bottom approach to ethics and morality, where when Canada's at its best, we're usually not doing that. We're trying the other thing, going up and setting a standard. Now, that standard's debatable given the history of this country, but the idealism is there.
But overall, I think this means that liberal attempts otherwise, it's basically impossible to pretend that this is just, you know, some small little kerfuffle, and there's nothing, you know, really to see here. If the OECD feels it's worth explicitly pointing out that prosecutions can't be declined for political reasons, you know, there's some meat here.
Well, one way we could get to more of the truth or to find out more would be for the Justice Committee to continue hearing from more witnesses, maybe have Jody Wilson-Raybould back, and continue to discuss these things in a public forum. Is that happening?
Nope. Well, maybe, but probably not. So the Justice Committee convened on Wednesday this week to discuss, and this was the opposition members of the committee had basically called it. And less than a half hour in, the Liberal tabled a motion to adjourn the meeting without having decided to call the former Attorney General in to testify.
And all the rest of the Liberals promptly voted in favor of it to screams of cover-up and corruption from the opposition members. Fine moments in Canadian democracy.
So this is not great at all, and just goes to show the limitations of using a partisan apparatus, despite protests to the contrary, that these committees are independent. It's very clear that they are not independent and are acting in a partisan manner, and it's just not the right way to hold government to account. And that's why there needs to be some sort of process, like an independent inquiry.
Yeah, this was, I mean, not this exact issue, but this issue of partisan committees and the majority throwing their weight around was one of the big issues under Harper, is the committees
were rubber
stamping.
It's basically an issue as long as there's been parliamentary majorities with strict party
discipline.
Some
of them have been a little bit more open.
But definitely over the decades as control gets centralized in the leader's office.
Yeah. So once again, real change evaporated when things got hot.
So they are coming back. Their next meeting is on Tuesday, and it's closed doors. And you know what else is Tuesday?
the budget.
Yes.
So all eyes will be on Bill Morneau, but for a different reason this time.
Of course, I think the Liberals are maybe being a bit hopeful if they think the budget alone can steer away from this controversy.
Well, so far, our engagement in a new space program, a apology to the Inuit, an important one about TB, and a PharmaCare interim report haven't managed to take the media's focus off of SNC.
Yeah, and this is a pre-election budget. There's going to be some goodies. We've already seen hints of job training, personal job training accounts, and electric car subsidies, but I mean, neither of those are going to be the sort of thing that's going to make Canadians forget that the Prime Minister probably tried to improperly influence in a criminal prosecution.
I think they might start going heavier and faster on the PharmaCare program, because that's one that Jagmeet Singh is going to be pushing for the next year as well. And maybe the Liberals can scoop them on that. But other than that, maybe throw some money at housing. Just really keep picking
up. They've announced a bunch. It's all happening after the election.
Yeah, just pick up all the NDP promises like they did in 2015. Only Mulcair didn't want to make some of them. But they could also make this pre-election budget just a very, like, election into budget, as this bizarre article from thesuburban.com.
Which, according to their banner, is Quebec's largest English weekly newspaper.
All right.
Which I had not heard of, but it's on the internet, so it must be true.
I guess it's a weekly newspaper as opposed to...
Yeah, that is fair.
Journal. Yeah, some of the English ones. But this columnist there, Mike Cohen, claims from sources that Trudeau's likely to call a May federal election.
So there's been rumors about this. It's definitely been making the rounds on Twitter before this article came out that, oh, maybe there'll be an early election.
This one is so bizarre because he just talks about sources and then he goes on to say, several suppliers who were called upon by candidates in federal elections have told me they were contacted already to be prepared to start printing material soon for a May vote. So catch the opposition off guard. He also misspells Bernier's first name as Maxime Bernier in the next half of the paragraph, so...
Anyone who made a typo.
Yeah. I'm just saying it kind of reflects on editorial and proofing standards that I don't take this very seriously, because I think he's still got a better shot holding off, letting the summer cool things down, and then playing the fear card constantly, as he's going to, and that's Trudeau's path to holding at least a minority.
They are behind in the polls right now. That's not always the great position to start an election in. I could see the calculus being made that, okay, we expect that this is going to drag out a while. There's potentially a bunch of stuff that's going to go really bad for us when the Mark Norman trial kicks off in August.
Which I should give a shout out to Oppo this week. Even though I keep joking that I love to hate the podcast, Justin Ling actually did a very thorough job explaining what the hell is going on in that scandal.
Yeah, do give it a listen, because there's potentially some quite explosive stuff that will come out when the trial goes forward, assuming the defense can get the disclosures they're seeking. So yeah, that, you know, if they see there's another scandal on the horizon, people are starting to talk about how it might impact things. They're worried SNC isn't going to go away and will drag out over the next 6 months or more. You know, there's maybe an idea of, you know, okay, we'll do it now. We won't let this fester. We've only dropped a few points. We can make it back once the election kicks off and it's into campaign mode. And you know, nobody's wowed by Andrew Scheer. And we don't play the fear card. I can kind of see it going that way. I mean, at the same time, it's a huge risk doing this in the middle of a scandal.
Yeah.
But, like, the Liberals haven't been shown a lot of strategic thought lately, so, and what little they are, it's the too clever by a half, so I could see them going for this.
Well, part of the problem with doing it is they would actually have to bring forward a bill to repeal the Fixed Election Act or change it in some way to do something, and that generates its own controversy and debate, because there are only other options to bring forward a confidence vote and, like, lose it on purpose. I guess that's embarrassing for a day or two, but I mean, I guess the fixed election date acts aren't super binding in the way that the Prime Minister could just go over to the Governor General and say, I don't really care about that law. Just call the election now. I'm the prime minister. And I don't know what would happen in that case. But then we'd have a, not a constitutional crisis, but a bit of a challenge. All of that said, I'm not a lawyer. And you know who else isn't a lawyer? Sheila Copps. She's been playing the liberal surrogate, both on TV and especially on Twitter. And the gem this week, after her previous racist side tweets about Jody Wilson-Raybould would actually care if it was 9,000 Aboriginal jobs, in Copps' words. This afternoon, Sheila Copps said, solicitor-client privilege ended the day the former Attorney General ceased being Attorney General. That was the day she stopped being the lawyer for the government. So did you know that after your lawyer is done working with you, he or she can tell all of your secrets to everyone? Because that's how the law works now?
That doesn't sound right.
I saw a lot of incredulous lawyers retweeting this on Twitter, including friend of the pod, Micah, who brought this to my attention. But, I mean, Sheila Copps was deputy prime minister. She didn't go to law school, but you have to think some point in her long political career, she would have interfaced with some, like, basics.
Not only that, like, at some point she must have dealt with a lawyer as a client, right? Would that not have been explained to her? Would she have just discussed those matters with her lawyer, she thought, the moment the relationship ended, everything she said was fair game?
At Sheila underscore Copps. Well, let's move on to quick takes. And I put Brexit in here as a quick take, and it definitely isn't. It's been a shit show of a week in the United Kingdom as they voted massively against one of Theresa May's deals again. And then that was 2 days ago. Then yesterday, they voted to reject no deal, saying we won't leave the EU without something. And today, she did win a vote to extend Article 50. The best part of this is just how on yesterday's, should the UK, you know, entertain the idea of leaving the European Union with no deal, almost her entire caucus voted against her. The only reason Theresa May can keep winning some votes is because the opposition, at least, is trying not to let the country be destroyed. Now, there are some Labour MPs who are going on weird vote sides of every one of these issues, but the Conservatives are overwhelmingly lost it. So I don't know where the UK's headed.
Yeah, it's a shit show over there. Has Brexit been officially upgraded from tire fire to, like, landfill inferno yet? Because it feels like it's getting pretty close.
Well, the ball is in European Council's hands right now, and any one of the other 27 member states can veto this Article 50 extension. It sounds like that's unlikely, but that would add some new twist to this drama.
Well, from the European Union's perspective, why bother granting it an extension? It's been more than 2 years since the vote. It's basically coming up on the 2-year mark for the Article 50 invocation in, like, 14 days or so?
End of the month, at latest, I think.
They've already negotiated a deal. May came back to them to tweak a few things. That also didn't pass the UK Parliament. There is just a problem that cannot be solved on the Irish border while maintaining separation from the EU, no border between the two islands, and no internal border in the UK. That's just a problem that cannot be solved, and yet nobody's willing to proceed with anything that doesn't solve that problem. What does 90 days actually do for them? And why would they even bother agreeing with it if they're just going to be in the same spot 90 days later?
I think tanking the UK's economy will have knock-on effects for the rest of the world, at least for Europe. And so there is still some interest, I imagine, in Europe to not let this happen in the worst case. I've heard some speculation about, like, can't the EU just, like, force Britain to have elections? And the obvious,
no, they can't.
Yeah, the obvious answer is no, but they kind of need to, because the UK is, like, stuck in this situation where the government keeps getting defeated on massive votes, or the only way it can get, like, the necessary ones through is with the opposition, which suggests May doesn't actually have the confidence of her party. But no one in her party wants her out yet, because no one wants to deal with this until we're at a later stage, when maybe Boris Johnson will pick up the Flaming Tire Fire.
Also, she can't actually be deposed by her party for, what, like 10 more months?
Oh, they have those weird rules.
They're like, you can't do it within a year thing because they tried to get rid of her and not enough conservatives hated her just then to do it.
She also had a bunch of her cabinet members vote against her on one of the recent votes, which is a sure sign of solidarity. It's a mess, and will continue going that way.
But even if they have elections, it's not entirely clear how that's going to even improve the situation, because like Labour is not exactly doing well either. They don't have a particularly coherent Brexit position.
It's because their voters don't.
Well, yeah, but yeah. they don't have a particularly coherent position. They're dealing with some of their own scandals at the moment. The fact that Labour isn't like just massively ahead of in the polls, given how terrible the Conservatives are doing at the most important issue in Britain right now, really says, I think, a lot about where Labour is. So what happens after an election? Like, there's no like clear distinctions between the two main parties on Brexit, like enough for you to really resolve these outstanding issues.
Well, there's bigger internal debates than there are external or between them.
If the voters do come back, like how do the voters actually change things so that this deadlock gets resolved if the parties can't?
Well, they could go for one of the growing number of, I guess, EU-philic parties out there. But to tell you how great they're doing, the Liberal Democrats, the traditional center-left party, now has fewer MPs than a splinter group of Labour and some conservative MPs called the Independent Group, who are indistinguishable from the Lib Dems, other than they just know that's a toxic brand. So,
which really says something about how bad the Lib Dems have screwed up, that Lib Dems, but not called the Lib Dems, is the best way to go forward for that group.
So I think because this is in quick takes, I'll leave Brexit there. It's just been a wild week to watch. And I'm continually trying to update my voter registration just in case.
Moving on. Since last Sunday, there's been an ongoing issue across the world about whether or not to ground the Boeing 737 MAX series. And this has been interesting, the fact that there's been quite a few divergences kind of across the globe on what is normally a very uniformed approach to airline safety.
So this followed an Ethiopian Airlines crash that killed a lot of people, including 18 Canadians recently. And this was the second of these airplanes to go down recently.
Yes. Back in the fall, there was a crash in Indonesia with the same model of airplane. And it's still early in the investigation, but looks like a very similar crash, which has raised a lot of safety concerns over this aircraft.
So some countries made a very quick call that they're going to ground the planes. Canada and the U.S., I think, were a bit slower, but
we're basically, I think, the last two major countries to ground the planes.
And it looks like we did it even as Boeing, or just after Boeing, said, yeah, we kind of think everyone should ground the planes.
I believe it was just before. Once the U.S. government had gotten to the point where they were grounding the planes, Boeing was like, yeah, we should probably ground the planes.
I don't know that they use the most airplanes in the world. Maybe China does. But
I believe it's the U.S. followed by China in terms of size of fleet. And I think we're number three.
Yeah. You know, once those major powers start saying, this product seems unsafe, the manufacturer is in a pretty difficult spot to not say, you know, I guess there's an issue with this product.
And it hasn't been determined that this is a fault with the aircraft. Like, I think there's been something like 17,000 flights just in the U.S. with this model of aircraft. So it's not entirely clear that this is a safety issue with the aircraft, but the very similar nature of the two crashes definitely hints that it might be a problem with the software designed to keep the plane from stalling, which, if you know anything about airplanes, basically means to keep the plane flying, and it appears it might do the opposite of that and force the plane down.
Yeah, we as a society, I actually think, take air travel pretty seriously. It and like nuclear power and maybe a couple other industries, we actually go, these are very serious things that when done wrong kill lots of people, so let's be very precautious. Look at automobile traffic. 30,000 people die a year in the States. Not banning any cars yet. Obviously we still need them, but we don't really treat anything else as seriously. And so I think this is a good move we can figure these things out, there are other kinds of planes, and it creates a few days of disruption, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more, but...
It's definitely causing issues. I think it's probably going to last about 3 weeks for the airlines to get this sorted out. That get their delay sorted out.
Yeah.
It might be longer for Boeing to figure out, A, if it's a fault with the plane, and B, what the fix is, and C, how to get that implemented.
Yeah, important move, and good to see Canada join. Do we have any word of why Canada was slower than some of the other countries?
Well, I think part of it is that it wasn't entirely clear that this was a fault with the aircraft. What apparently tipped Canada over into it was there was some new satellite data that became available that basically showed very similar flight paths between the two airline crashes, which was enough to convince the minister that it was time to ground the planes. But there were definitely calls throughout the week leading up to the decision. And it is kind of interesting that us and the States were the two countries that didn't do it as quickly. It's one of those technical things that it's easy to say, yes, we should ground it right away. And you know, I think abundance of caution is definitely a reasonable approach to take. I'm not necessarily sure you can conclude that the opposite, that, you know, not immediately grounding the planes is somehow negligent. So it's complicated.
Yeah. Well, hopefully Boeing sorts this out sooner rather than later, and we can ensure the safety of all our aircraft. Coming back to British Columbia, the official disclosures for how much money was spent during the proportional representation referendum is out, and it looks like over $2 million was spent in total. The total spent in support of PR was $1.3 million versus the $870,000 spent by opponents. So it was almost not quite a 2-to-1 spending ratio. The interesting things in some of the spending is all three of the political parties, the major political parties, had funding or spending limits of $200,000. The NDP spent $196,000. So you can't say they didn't actually try. Well, the Greens and Liberals both spent around $173,000 to $175,000, which in this kind of situation, it's sometimes better to be a little bit safe and not go over the limit and then face fines for that and get in trouble. There were a bunch of other smaller advertisers that didn't spend much. The interesting thing for the official campaigns is the pro-PR side, Vote PRBC. Their donations came from people of all sizes. So they raised almost $80,000 from people giving over $250. Well, they got $70,000 almost from those making smaller donations of under $250. Well, most of the no sides money came from those bigger donations. So it was people who could give more who didn't like PR. It was kind of everyone who threw money at the yes PR. I think there was still the $1,200 limit on donations on that, if I recall correctly.
I believe so. I didn't actually read the rules that closely on spending.
The biggest third-party advertisers was Fair Vote Canada, which spent $192,000. BCGEU, the big union, spent $84,000, both supporting PR. But overall, like value for dollar spent, it seems like the no side crushed it. And a large part of that seems like they spent their money on traditional media, whereas the pro-PR threw it at social media trying to get us and younger folk out to vote. And that just didn't work as well. So,
yeah, part of it was definitely how they spent their money. But I think it also kind of shows that money isn't everything in politics. And like a lot of cases, I think people overestimate the role that money actually has in determining votes. And I think this is particularly striking just because of the fairly large discrepancies. But it's worth keeping in mind that money isn't inherently just an instant win.
Yeah, sometimes when you put a needlessly complex referendum before people, no amount of money can help.
It was two questions. Wasn't that complicated?
No, I know. We did our best.
Although DUP was complicated. Like, that was not an easy one to work through in one's ads. Moving on, yesterday the BC government announced that they were changing the BC building code to increase the height that buildings can be built to out of wood up to 12 stories. So mass timber's been around for a little while as a building material. At one point, Vancouver or UBC had the tallest wood building in the world at 18 stories.
They held that record for like a week or something, wasn't it?
There's a few in the works in Europe. I think it was beaten fairly quick. But yeah, this is a change to basically incentivize them, align the regulations more to allow that sort of building.
Yeah, so this is engineered wood, not just...
It's not the stick frame you see and like when you're driving by like a random house being built. This is big, thick pieces of wood that've been engineered to provide a much more capable structure, like glue laminated or cross laminated timber. And it works quite well as a building material and can actually have performance similar to steel or concrete in a lot of applications.
So it's cheaper. You can build it, or
it's not quite cheap. It's concrete construction still cheaper for that, but part of it's the industry is fairly new. You don't have many suppliers in the market. The contractors aren't familiar with it. It's quicker to build.
Yeah. It's more environmentally friendly.
Yes, because concrete is really bad for the environment.
A lot of greenhouse gases in its production.
A lot.
Versus, well, I guess here you are chopping down trees, but renewable trees.
Also, trees store carbon and concrete releases it.
Yeah.
Even if we eliminated fossil fuels from making concrete, it would still basically produce half the emissions would still happen just from cement manufacturing, even with no fossil fuels involved.
One of the other bonuses of these wood frame buildings for us here on the West Coast is they are flexible. And that sounds like a bad thing for a building, but it actually turns out that can be really helpful when you have an earthquake because the building doesn't fall apart.
Brittle buildings do not do well in earthquakes.
It's terrifying seeing some of the skyscrapers that are designed to sway to manage with all of the different kind of effects.
Oh, there's some really cool engineering that goes in there.
Yeah. This is the small version of that.
Yeah, giant hanging steel balls at the top of buildings, like weird angles to shed wind vortices. It's cool. I think one of the concerns that always gets thrown around, though, is fire, because people assume that, small little wood stick frame buildings burn easily, so big wood buildings must burn easily, but actually it's the opposite and can actually have better fire resistance than even steel, because what happens when these buildings catch on fire is the outside part of the wood just chars and the inside load-bearing parts are still fine.
So can jet fuel melt wood beams?
With a large accelerant, yeah, you should probably cause a fair bit of damage. Also, you don't need to melt steel for it to fail.
Yeah. But yeah, this is a fairly simple but good change. It sounded to me like municipalities now have to take it up themselves, which I guess is the perpetual weak link in provincial policy. In some cases, it might be the strong link, but...
Yeah, it doesn't really help if the building code allows 12 stories of mass timber when the zoning code allows 2 stories most of anything.
For many municipalities in BC, that's kind of irrelevant. Like, Caramillos isn't going to be needing to build a timber skyscraper or Fort St. John, but in the lower mainland.
The second largest mass timber build, I think, is in Prince George. It's in Prince George, I believe.
Prince George is a reasonable-sized city for the north. But, yeah, here in Metro Van, this could be a very good thing. And the other thing the NDP is playing up, because it plays into their base talking point line, is here's a use for BC wood in BC. You know, process those raw logs here. Jobs, jobs, jobs. And it's actually a reasonable argument.
Yeah, I mean, it's a safe building material, which it is. There's no reason to not have a building code that allows it. I think the must-produce wood things in BC is maybe not the most solid economic logic, but there's definitely no reason that the building code should discourage it.
Well, one change the BC NDP is making that's drawing a bit more criticism than that is they're tweaking around with some of the Agricultural Land Commission's terms of reference and the legislation governing that. And the BC Liberals have thrown a lot of criticism at this. It happens many of their voters live on farms in agricultural land reserves. And specifically what's happening, as far as I can tell, is the changes are trying to redefine person in the act to say that if you want to make a change to your farm on the agricultural land reserve, you need to apply to your local governing authority or First Nation or prescribed body.
Basically, the municipal government has to
sign
be
off.
Your conduit to the Agricultural Land Reserve Commission to make any changes to it.
And so because they're changing the word person in there, the BC Liberals are saying this is basically it's the same is actually what House Leader Mary Polak said on Twitter as how women were not persons under the law in the person's case. So women were human, but could not act as persons. This is redefining person for the purpose of the ALC exclusion application. They're trying to draw an analogy between a bureaucratic change and like a fundamental undermining of half of the population, roughly's human rights and dignity.
Bit of hyperbole?
Yeah, it's not a great look. I get people are pissed about this, sort of. Not even really. I guess because some municipalities, as we literally just said, aren't that great at doing things. But still, don't compare legislation to fundamental issues. I want to just finish off with a quote from the oldest MLA here in British Columbia, Ralph Sultan from the BC Liberals, who's quoted, as Shannon points out in our Slack, in the North Shore News, in a story about Andrew Wilkinson talking about the speculation tax at the West Van Yacht Club, which...
It's on brand, I guess.
Yeah.
Not in a good way, but it's on brand.
But Ralph Sultan, the MLA for West Van, says, good heavens, are we going to have people living in West Vancouver who are employees of Starbucks, and that will sustain the economy? I don't think so. Heaven forbid.
So what was the context there?
Sultan conceded that, quote, this crazy government has balanced the budget and overseen Canada's lowest unemployment rate. But he's saying jobs have grown in things like health, education, arts, and what he calls the barista sector.
It's an entire sector now.
He's figuring the NDP are screwing the manufacturing sector, and there are losses in construction and resources, and hence the only way West Vancouverites are going to be able to make money is working at Starbucks. West Vancouver is a special place, who recently, as I talked about on CanB Report with Patrick and Matthew, actually, I don't think I've talked about it since, but they did vote down extending the B-line into their city because who in West Van takes the bus? It lives up to every stereotype of the place was literally founded by wealthy Brits who didn't want to come across into the, you know, proletarian side of the inlet.
It's a special place. Yeah. And yeah, if you want to make the argument that municipal government is broken and hyperlocalism leads to bad outcomes, West Vancouver is definitely one of the places you can point to. And that has been Politikos. Find links to everything we talked about at politikos.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politikos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Sergei Plotnikov. Thanks for listening.